Welcome to Who Is She? A Bechdel Test Fest podcast. Every episode, we're going to explore the legacy of an extraordinary woman in film and how she changed the landscape of cinema for the better. This week, we're taking a look into the life and films of Joanna Hogg, a filmmaker who made her feature debut at 47, and now, three films later, presents one of the most sophisticated and visually compelling films of 2019, The Souvenir. I'm your host, Beth Webb, and I'm joined today by my Bechdel Test Fest partners in crime.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Who have I got with me?
Karina Antrobus.
And Caitlin Quinlan.
And Steph Watts.
Hello, ladies.
Hello.
All right. So without further ado, let's take a deep dive into the colourful and unconventional career of filmmaker Joanna Hogg with The Souvenir as our launching pad. Now, Steph, could you set us up for the film and tell us a little bit about what it's about?
Yeah, sure. So it's about Julie, who's a young, wealthy filmmaker living in London. And it's about her making films, but also about her relationship with this kind of mysterious older guy.
Now, for Who Is She? I recently was very lucky to speak with Joanna in London about the film. We spoke about her career so far, navigating as a woman in the film industry, and also the beautiful, beautiful outfits, the makeup, the looks of the three key characters in this film. We've got the interview for you right here. I wanted to go a little bit into the process that went into making the film. I understand you don't really write scripts. Am I right in saying that's sort of a kind of script treatment hybrid? Is that a fair thing to say?
Yes, I never know what to call it, but maybe it is a screenplay, in fact, because I'm describing images and I'm describing the story, but the only thing I omit is the dialogue. So I'll have some examples of the dialogue. Rather like in a novel, you'll get dialogue of what people say, but it's not pages of dialogue like a conventional script.
And what freedom does that sort of give to you that you wouldn't get from a conventional script?
It allows me to expand on the story when I'm shooting, and it's probably about 30 pages long. It's not too daunting. I don't have to refer to it very much. I pretty much memorize it, so I'm not carrying around this written document. I'm free then to look at what's in front of me, come up with other ideas, and not be sort of limited in a way by this document.
That's amazing, and I guess that intensifies, or maybe that's not the right word, but that has a certain impact on the relationship that you have with the people in your film, because you communicate with them in a much more immediate way than if they just go away and read pages and come up onto set. Is that right?
Well, that's right. I feel that I'm much more present as a result. I'm not constantly referring to something. It feels sort of braver and freer in a way, and then I'm having to really look at somebody and listen to them, and also listen to myself, but not have there's no crutch.
Yes, and how did that work with somebody who hadn't necessarily had experience, or any experience, I believe, like in front of a camera? How did that work? That must have been very intuitive between the two of you.
Yes, it was. I mean, in the case of Honor, who plays Julie, who hadn't, yes, as you say, acted in anything before, it was her first experience in front of the camera in this way. She also wasn't encumbered. She didn't see the document that I'd written. So it was about me explaining things to her, although I didn't need to explain that much. But she knew that it was a story of a young woman who wants to be a filmmaker, but she didn't know anything about the relationship that was going to unfold. And she met Anthony, the character played by Tom Burke, for the first time in the scene of the party, which is at the beginning of the film. So that was the first scene that she shot. That we shot together, and she met him in that scene. So I myself am present in the moment through the process, and then I encourage everybody else to be the same way.
Yes, it feels incredibly authentic, and she's got such a, this is such a kind of blasé thing to say, but she's got such a look to her that feels so pinpointed to that era. Like, how did you know what you were looking for when you found that in her?
Well, I was looking for that. I didn't know I was looking for that precise thing in her, but I was looking for that feeling of that era, and in a way that innocence of, you know, all the social media and all the selfies, and someone who wasn't in a way interested in that that generational thing that's so present now, someone who's sort of grown up away from that kind of spotlight of themselves in a sense. And so, yeah, I already knew her, but I feel like I met her for the first time when I considered her to be Julie. And I saw something quite old-fashioned in her in a way, or something certainly from the 80s that I recognised of myself back then.
Yeah, and then she's got just this timeless look to her, like a wonderful, wonderful actress. And then I guess what ties her more to the era, though, I need to talk about the clothes. So it's Grace Snell that you worked with, that's her name there. How did you find, were any of the clothes yours, like some of those statement pieces are so mesmerizing and memorable. Like, how did you work together to get those looks?
Yes. Well, Grace, it was the first time I'd worked with her, because with my previous films, my production designer, Stéphane Collange, had also done the costume design. But then with The Souvenir, it was a much more... a bigger project, and you know, it wasn't possible. He was going to have enough work to do as a production designer. So we needed to find a costume designer. And actually, I credit Stefan with finding Grace, because he made contact with her and met her. And then I met her, and we agreed that she would be a wonderful addition to our cinema family. And she was really wonderful to work with. And she's very open to... bringing in, you know, for example, Anna bought some of her own things into the costume department. But some of those early pieces are mine, in fact. There's a scarf, a Vivienne Westwood scarf that Julie wears at the beginning, that then Anthony wears in different ways. He wears it as a turban,
his head, yes.
And then they dance with it. And this scarf, in fact, this scarf is in the second part as well. Anyway, it sort of travels through the decade. And then there are other things, pretty much everything that Julie wears at the first party scene that she has where she meets Anthony were mine from that time. And then there were various things through. And then Tilda, who she and I back in the day wore some of similar things to each other, she brought in some of her things for Julie to wear.
Oh, that's so fun. I love that. I absolutely love that.
But then I want to just say about Grace is that she's, yeah, so she encourages that approach, but then she also designs beautiful clothes. I mean, there's a dress that Julie wears in Venice, a ball dress.
Yes.
And that was a very exciting thing.
She designed that herself.
So Grace designed that. And then many, many other things. So it's a combination of clothes that Grace designs, but then also clothes that come in that were from that time. Or she's very good at finding things in charity shops. So in Norfolk, where we shot the film, you know, she went to some charity shops, and she finds incredible things. She's just got, I mean, she works in a very similar way to me, in that she's very much very instinctive, and she really, yeah, it's really follows ideas and picks up on things and is very, yeah, super sensitive.
Yes, I think I need to go charity shopping in Norfolk because yeah. She's bringing it. Now, obviously, we have a very strong focus on women in film and what we do. And obviously, as a collective, a scene that really speaks to us is when Julie's being very openly patronised on set by a male, counterpart, I suppose. And obviously, that must be quite deeply rooted in a reality somewhere. Or if not, it felt very, very raw. Could you tell me if that is something that you've sort of experienced in that way? How you personally navigate through those scenarios where you're being sort of belittled, perhaps, or as I say, sort of spoken down to in a certain way in a very public space?
Yeah, well, fortunately, it hasn't happened to me for many years.
Yes.
But when I worked in television, actually not so much at film school, but when I worked in television, there were situations I found myself in, series that I was working on, where I would come across somebody that would be a character who would be patronizing in that way. Mm. And often in a very... not in an overt way. I mean, in a way, what I describe in The Souvenir in that scene is quite overt and quite seems quite obvious, but I've experienced it in more subtle ways, which is hard. It's harder to respond when it's quite subtle, or when you feel it's behind your back, because you know it sort of just sort of brings back kind of memories of that. But you know, if you say something, then you're sort of open to accusations of being paranoid, or of course you're wrong, or So I've been in situations, but they probably from to an outside eye might not have been that obvious. And then I've got sort of one regret in particular where I would have liked to have said something, you know, commented on it. You know, often you would just sort of deal with it, and then if you're directing something, you just got to carry on, basically, so you don't want to stop and say something to somebody. But anyway, there's one particular guy I'd like to get back at. But that scene in the film school, yes, it didn't happen. As I say, it didn't happen so much in film school, but I think I was sort of channeling some of these other experiences.
Yes, I think you maybe got back at him through this scene.
I think that's right. I think that's my revenge.
And how has your relationship, especially with the British film industry, how do you feel like that's changed specifically since this film? Well, no, I guess not since breaking out into film and then just coming through now to here. How do you feel like your relationship with the British film industry has changed?
It's very... I mean, I haven't had a relationship with the British film industry for very long, in a sense, because I made my first film unrelated, what seems like only a few years ago. But I've had a very... it's been very positive, actually. I haven't felt any... I don't have anything, any bad experiences to tell. I feel like I've been, very lucky so far. And very supported, touching wood, very superstitious. You just never know how long that's going to last in a way. But I hope I continue to get support. But I also see other people around me, other filmmakers who I think should get support and maybe aren't. And you know, there's so many factors involved. But and I'm not just talking about women. You know, young male filmmakers as well. It's not easy.
I feel like it is getting slightly more accessible, and I think it is quite an exciting time in many ways. Like, I know films like The Last Tree and Only You that's just come out, I think are really saying exciting, and visually they're very striking as well, which is something else I admire about your film there. But yes, it's interesting to kind of see. I'm excited to sort of see where it goes next, I think.
No, it's true. I mean, I'm aware, there are a lot of films being made, in a way, so that's a good thing. And yes. I guess the challenge is then getting those films seen.
Yes, this is true. And speaking of, and you've had your first US premiere with this film. How have you found that kind of adjustment to your career, I guess?
In some ways, you just continue with the work. It doesn't change anything, really. But at the same time, it's really gratifying to get new audiences to your work. And I've been very much in the bubble of making part one and now part two, so I haven't really thought outside of it too much. But it was very nice going to the States and showing part one there.
Yes.
Yeah, I look forward to going back with part two.
Is there something in particular that you've taken away from the experience of part one that you were like, I must remember to take that into this next film? In terms of your experience of making the film and creating that film, is there something or a lesson that you've learned or a real challenge that you thought, right, I need to ensure for this next chapter that I remember this?
Yeah, well, for me, the most important thing has been protecting my risk-taking. I made a decision after making part one that I wouldn't read any response to the film before I'd made part two, because I didn't want to go into the shoot of part two being self-conscious at all about what I'd done. So I wanted to go in with the same bravery that I went into part one with, and that's been really great. And actually, anyway, once you get into a film shoot, it's so intense. Every moment is you can't waste a second, so you actually forget about the outside world. But I was concerned about the response, good or bad, to part one. I didn't want to think, oh yes, well, it seems like audiences like that character, or maybe I'll make sure I've got more of that character in part two. I didn't want to hear anything at all. I wanted to stay in my own zone, so to speak.
That must have been hard.
Not too hard, actually, and I'm really glad I did, because now I'm still not going to look at things, but part two was really interesting, and it's going to be a very different film, and maybe not what people expect. I don't mind, but I've continued to take more risks with it.
Good. And finally, I'd love to talk to you about the music in the film. The soundtrack, to me, it felt almost like, which is quite a crass comparison, but almost like how Tarantino uses these real anthems from an era, but in such a bold way to sort of, I don't know how to describe it properly, but I'd love to know what you were wanting to say with the use of the pop tracks and the contemporary music from that time.
Yeah, I don't know if there was anything particular I wanted to say other than it was my way of creating an impression of that time. Because with the design of the film, I didn't want to fetishize the 1980s. I didn't want to... It's not that I wanted it to feel timeless, but I just didn't want to sort of enjoy those details because it's about something else. It's about this relationship. But with the music, that was a way of conjuring up that time, and I very much used tracks that... I listened to in the early 80s, and that when I listen to now bring back memories of that time.
Great, that's lovely. Actually, just one more final one, sorry. I'd love to know if your relationship with how you thought you saw yourself has changed, if that makes any sense, to how before you started making the film, did you see yourself in a certain way? And then when you finished the films, do you see yourself in a different way back then as to what you did?
Yeah, I mean, it might be easier to answer when I finish part two, yeah. but what occurred to me as you were asking that is that I think I've got more respect for myself as a young woman now than I had before I started the project.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much. That's great. And that was Joanna Hogg speaking with us exclusively for the Who Is She podcast. So we now arrive at the titular segment of the pod, where we shine a spotlight onto the career of our subject. So for this episode, we're going to open it up to Caitlin. And I ask Caitlin, Joanna Hogg, who is she?
Well, Beth. So Joanna Hogg is a London-born writer, director, producer, kind of began in telly and did a lot of television work before she kind of made her way into the film industry. She did study at film school, but I think she'd kind of struggled to get her foot in the film industry, but finally kind of broke out in 2007 with her first feature film, Unrelated.
All right, thank you, Caitlin. And Steph, what has she done?
So like Caitlin said, she started off working in TV, and she was also making music videos for people like Alison Moyet, people like that. She did an episode of EastEnders called Dot Story, which is apparently really, really good.
I've heard amazing things about Dot Story.
Yeah. I've seen it.
Really?
I've actually seen it. I remember watching EastEnders as a child-ish, and I remember seeing this very odd, arty, what I thought at that time was a bit poncy episode of EastEnders. Turns out now, however many years later, it was Joanna Hogg.
Art.
So she did that and then went on to make Unrelated in 2007. And that was the start of a long time collaboration with a little guy called Tom Hiddleston, who
Who is he?
I think that might have been kind of when he was just starting out, before he got into the Avengers and the Marvel universe and all his other stuff.
What I remember is his first IMDb credit as a proper film. And I think he's incredible. No wonder he's taken off. But Unrelated, the performance in Unrelated is magnificent.
Yeah, and then in Archipelago and Exhibition, he's really great in those as well.
Yeah, Exhibition got such a small part, but it's still very important. He's like the
estate agent.
Yeah.
She must have been like finding time for him
then. Yeah, that was very much like a,
Tom, do you want to be in my next project?
Can you squeeze it in?
I think she said actually she was quite worried that she had him on the billing and then people might have thought by then he was pretty big and people might have been like, oh, I'm going to see a Tom Hiddleston film. And then he's just like this weird.
He's maybe in it for like all of 5 minutes.
Yeah, but. Missed it, but oh well.
But yeah, her films are so kind of unarguably middle class. She was credited with spearheading a new type of social realism in British film by Nick Roddick, Insight and Sound.
Thank you. I think that's a really important point that we're going to get to you with how she addresses class in her films. And maybe that's something Karina can expand on when I ask you, Karina, why do we love Joanna Hogg?
Well, I mean, I know why I love her, and I feel like you all agree with everything I say, but, which is not true. Why do we love Joanna Hogg? I think she brings a real refreshment to the cinema scene in her style. She has a real embrace of authenticity and natural realism, and that is both within her craft and what is eventually delivered in her films. So we know that she doesn't have scripts, for instance, which I think is a very interesting way of creating work. And she also films in chronological order all the time as well, which I think is really interesting because you then get this real authenticity of the characters and the story unfolding, which otherwise just seems a little bit scripted. And you'll see by watching all the films that there is such a you never really know what's going to happen next, and you get the impression that the actors don't either. Mm. And it's really wonderful result on that. So particularly in The Souvenir, anybody that might think, has Honor just forgotten her lines? No, it's just Honor trying to feel out what the next part of the story is going to be, because what's fascinating to us as the viewer is that we know that she doesn't even know yet.
Yeah. Well, this is what she talks about in the interview, as you'll have heard, is she calls them scriptments, I think, or that's how they've largely been described, between a script and a treatment. Mm. And she kind of goes in just with an idea or feeling and then lets the dialogue run freely in her takes.
She really lets all the scenes breathe to the point of quite an uncomfortable point sometimes, and you're just wondering if anything else is going to happen. And the shots are usually drawn back, so there's all this room in the on the screen for things to happen, and you're sort of sitting there. It's quite representative of how horror films are sometimes shot, because you've got all these big open wide scenes which create mystery and a vague anxiety as to what's going to happen next. And what's interesting about Joanna Hogg's films is that she does that before drama or just her own autobiographical stories, and I think it really, really works for her.
We touched on her take on class, and as we say, they've been described largely as kind of middle class realism, if we can even use that as a term, maybe.
So yeah, we'll go with that.
Caitlin, what do you think about that? Would you say that's a fair thing to say about her work?
I think it's definitely a fair thing to say about her work, that she does kind of shoot situations and people in life experiences that she obviously can understand and can relate to in lots of ways, as I think lots of directors do. But there's something that I find kind of very interesting about the way that she does that, and this kind of approach to sort of documenting privilege and documenting the middle classes in a way that doesn't always happen on film. And it might be sort of, you know, considered difficult to relate to in some cases, or people feel a certain distance, you know, to the characters in her films because it's not a life that we're all necessarily accustomed to. But to me, that's really important, that we do have filmmakers that tell these stories and that, you know, kind of interrogate situations of privilege and people that live in privilege, because otherwise we end up with a lot of stories about poverty or the working class or people in sort of traumatic and dire circumstances where their stories have to constantly be sad and there has to be trouble. And, you know, if we only ever told the stories of rich people when their lives were so positive and happy, we would never create this kind of fair and equal balance across, you know, the things that we need to talk about in cinema. So I think, you know, people say they watch her films and they can't feel sorry for rich people, but really what we should be looking at is the way that she's incredibly self-aware, and she knows that all her characters can be quite insufferable, I think, and they're quite awful a lot of the time. But what she's trying to do is say, you know, look, this is just somebody's life, and I'm gonna observe it for an hour or, you know, or two.
But I think a lot of the class and the privilege are accessory to the actual plot of what's going on, because you've got things like heartbreak or realizing that you can't have kids later or your marriage breaking down, and that transcends class, I think. Those things definitely happen to everyone. So I'm very interested to see what Joanna's telling of those issues are, which is able to, you know, a lot of them I relate to, but I haven't been brought up in the way she has. So but there's a very human element to her work, And I think that, yeah, I think that can be relatable to anyone.
Definitely. And I think in The Souvenir especially, it's much more about, well, in all of her films really, there's so much about what it means to be a woman, so much about what it means to be at that certain point of your life, whether it's your, you know, early 20s in like Julie in The Souvenir as she's sort of starting film school, or, you know, any of the characters in Unrelated or Exhibition, whether it's, you know, they're in their 40s maybe and they're kind of coming to terms with the end of relationships. There's a lot about what it means to just be a woman in various stages of life.
Steph, you saw Archipelago and found it a little bit difficult to watch. Would you say that's...
Yeah, I don't think I connected with it in the same way that I did with The Souvenir. I think if I'd seen Archipelago before The Souvenir, I probably would have thought more like Joanna Hogg's making films about like the kind of class that she's from, the like area that she's from, and that's it. I don't think she was kind of analysing why she was doing it or thinking about sticking to her own lane. I think that might be more like, well, I'm making these films and that's kind of what I'm making my films about. But then I think with The Souvenir, there's a lot more reflection on why she might make those films, because you have this kind of whole storyline of Julie wanting to make film about Sunderland and the kind of working classes on the docks, and a lot of people questioning that and kind of saying, well, you're not from this area, you don't know this way of life, why would you want to make that film? And a lot of question about kind of appropriating that class for your own gain.
Yeah, it's a very self-aware work, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that more so than Archipelago. Just,
But if you think of the time between those two films, she's showing a real strength as she's depicting her own wisdom. Mm-hmm. And she's probably looking back at that time, and it takes that amount of space to look back at your younger days or your youth and go, oh yeah, I really thought I knew it all. And actually, that was a bit of a dick move.
I bet Joanna Hogg thinks that all the time. Yeah. God, Joanna, that was a dick move. Now, in the interview, we heard Joanna speak a little bit about her experiences as a filmmaker in the industry. She's generally had a pretty harmonious might be a stretch. She seems to have got on with the film industry thus far, but does obviously appreciate misogyny within the film industry. There's a very poignant scene in The Souvenir where she's openly patronized by a male superior on the set of her film. How did we feel about that scene in particular to watch? So just to set it up a little bit, Julie, she's in film school. She's trying to direct a scene in a big air hangar, which is this beautiful setting for the film, where I think a lot of the film's actually been shot. She tried to do it all in one location. And it's her trying to navigate through this scene, and there's a male superior on set who just openly patronizes her in front of her crew. At least that's how
really
I interpret it.
This is funny, because I interpreted that completely differently. Like, she doesn't know what she's doing. I found, like, you know, she has the typewriter in the film, and she's writing on the typewriter, like, this is my first scene, blah, blah, blah. And then later on, she just uses it to, like, make a holiday list. And she just, like, the filmmaking has completely gone out the window. Yeah. She's like, yeah, use this typewriter, just write money, clothes, passport. And I found that kind of, that scene where she doesn't know where she's doing is more of kind of a wake-up call of, actually, I should be putting more passion into this or more time into it, because she does kind of stray away from study. And I find that quite funny that it's interpreted two ways.
Because I probably would have said the same as you. Like, for so much of the film, there are moments where she kind of, somebody on the set will say, well, we can't do it that way because we have to do it this way, or because, you know, as if it's just so obvious that how could she have missed that, you know, that that fact of filmmaking, which is true. And I think there's something interesting that, yeah, we read it kind of as like, she doesn't know what she's doing. She's this incredibly naive character who's just so sort of all over the place because of a very sort of troubled relationship in her life. But that also, that, you know, that that's where the crossover exists, that she doesn't know what she's doing in filmmaking necessarily. She doesn't know what she's doing in this relationship, and she allows men to walk all over her in lots of ways. And there are some other scenes that I find particularly uncomfortable, or just sort of, they resonate with me in a way that's, you know, sad, because she's just so apologetic for things that she doesn't need to apologize for, where somebody else has done wrong, especially the man she's in a relationship with.
The most heartbreaking
thing. Yeah, and it's really difficult to sort of watch, because I think that, as I say, that is something that really resonates with me. And that's, yeah, there is that crossover with, you know, the scenes where she's trying to be a director and you know, men on set are telling her that she's doing it wrong. Mm. And she is doing it wrong, yeah. But, you know, she's learning, she's trying to grow. And it's very, yeah, it's hard to watch her in both those scenarios, I think.
Mm. Yeah, I think we've all been that girl at some point, of somebody telling us what to do, or some guy basically taking advantage of our naivety and youth and trying to literally dress us up as he does in one scene, mm. like a little doll, and get us to, you know, walk around in the way that they want.
That scene is just so,
yeah,
I think it's
a beautiful scene. It's kind of tattooed itself onto my brain.
Can you let us know what the scene is for the benefit of people who haven't seen it yet?
So it's a moment where Julie is kind of entering her own bedroom, and Anthony, played by Tom Burke, who is the man she's in a relationship with, is sort of waiting for her in her bed, and she's wearing this special lingerie set that he's brought her back from Paris or Venice, I can't quite remember. And we just see her standing in the doorway, and it's sort of quite a wide shot of the whole room. And there's something about that scene that I can, even just speaking about it now, I can picture every sort of bit of that frame where she's hovering in the doorway, and you're so aware that she's being looked at in so many ways. And it's almost like we have an out of body experience for her, where we're so, I mean, for me anyway, I felt how she felt being looked at. And I felt all those things of wanting to like kind of hide my body and sort of not be so exposed and so vulnerable in a moment like that. Mm. And you feel all of those things for her just because of the way that Joanna Hogg has framed this moment. And we're just the kind of gaze that we have upon Julie.
I felt like that particular, the way that the camera is almost like a CCTV footage frame, because it's got that much space in it. It's not very close up and you can't see the facial elements. It's just you're observing voyeuristically this very uncomfortable scene that's supposed to be quite sexy, but actually it's just really,
it's something in the way that Honor Swinton-Byrne stands as well. It's just like sums the whole thing up for me.
I think it just sums her up as kind of this very young, naive, doesn't really know what she's doing type character, and she's got so much to learn. And I think just watching her be kind of smothered a little bit by this figure in her life that she looks up to, and just kind of lets him take over a little bit. It's really hard to watch when you just kind of see somebody like who should be either completely kind of getting involved in studying or just doing something completely different, and they're just kind of sitting, taking a back seat kind of in their life a little bit, just because they don't know any better and they think this person is older, they're gonna just kind of show me how to live.
Because he's a lot older, right?
I think he's supposed to be a bit older.
I think he's meant to be like a fair bit older.
Yeah,
there's sort of the suggestion that he works in the Foreign Office or he's got a life
before
her that she's somehow just fallen
they
into.
Are worlds apart, yet they found themselves orbiting each other somehow in this really uncomfortable
and that the kind of the power dynamics that are on display there, I think that's what makes Joanna Hogg's approach so special, especially when we think about, you know, what we were saying before about lack of scripts or these scriptments, you know, where she was really able to kind of embed the power dynamics in the very fabric of the story, because Tom Burke was sort of privy to much more information about the plot and what was going to happen later on in the film than Honor Swinton-Byrne was. So in lots of ways, the power dynamic is you know, clearly defined from the beginning, and Anthony is always going to have more power over Julie because the actor, you know, fundamentally knows more than the other actor does.
Yeah.
So there's something really interesting there, I think, for me, that it's so layered and Julie's naivety is you know, comes through very naturally in Honor's performance because she was naive herself in the very kind of, you know, basic understanding of the word. But then I also love the fact that, you know, we don't necessarily see, you know, the first take each time. So it's not like we're watching Honor Swinton-Byrne improvise and, you know, she's done a scene a couple of times and she's aware, you know, it's not necessarily the first time that we see her. If she's, you know, learning a new piece of information or something. There's one moment in particular that I'm kind of referring to, but won't spoil. But within that as well, it's kind of understanding how Julie is, you know, lying to herself and willfully ignoring truths that she's, you know, maybe understood longer than she's letting on. That's just fascinating for me. I think in the filmmaking, it's embedded in that structure.
But don't you think it's interesting that, and if that was a male director, getting a young girl who didn't know what was going to happen next, whereas the guy knew exactly what was going to happen next, that power dynamic, which actually she's managed to nurture and use so well. Can you imagine
might
if
be exploited?
Yeah, it would possibly be seen the other way around if it was a. But I mean, Joanna Hogg has a personal relationship with Honor. Mm-hmm. What with it being Tilda Swinton's daughter and her and Tilda Swinton being lifelong friends, and so yeah, there's been a real opportunity. I wouldn't call it abuse in any sense of the word, because it's a really beautiful opportunity that she's been able to take advantage of and create something really wonderful. And Honor has from all the interviews that I've read, she's really benefited from the experience. She's loved it.
Yeah.
What would we like to say about Joanna's filmmaking aesthetic? She's notoriously got quite a famous mentor, Martin Scorsese. What would you say are kind of common themes or traits in terms of how she frames things? How do you respond to the way that the films look that you've watched? Because we all went away and specifically looked at a film each, didn't we? So, Karina, what did you say?
I really enjoy her use of location and space as, for lack of a less tacky word, the third character between the two individuals that the plot is surrounding around. And I love the fact that in Unrelated, you're instantly sucked into this very lovely, lush world of Italy, and they're on this. It turns out to be basically the worst summer holiday vacation for a 40-something-year-old woman, even though it's got everything that it should have been. But yeah, she essentially she's gone away for an escape from whatever it is that's going on in her relationship, and then the trajectory is just following her reclaiming herself away from her marriage, reconnecting with her friends' sons, who are a lot younger, a lot more cocksure, happy-go-lucky, drunken, having a laugh, smoking weed. And she's just kind of, not only is she a tourist in Italy, she's a tourist in her own childhood. And there's only so far that you can do that before you actually have to remind yourself, actually, I'm not there anymore. Mm. I've moved on. And it's an appreciation of the age that she's at. And then something else happens that makes her realize that there's certain other things that a 40-year-old woman may or may not be able to do anymore. And that's an interesting grapple of that. But I think, going back to the question, it's a very authentic portrayal of a very innate feeling for women. It's a very feminist story, and it's you're with her all along, and you're when she's sad, you're sad, and at no point do you ever think, what a silly woman, which you could in the wrong director's hands, but you're always sympathetic with her. And I think it's a beautiful film, and I wish I'd seen it before. I saw Exhibition, and I would like to see it again if I have the same feels on it, but it's really confirmed that she's a wonderful filmmaker.
Steph, what do you think about, I suppose The Souvenir would probably be the best point of reference for you.
Yeah, I guess just kind of body language and placement of actors in the space is quite, I think, something quite interesting. I mean, yeah, with Archipelago, there's that kind of awful scene where Tom Hiddleston's character is trying to kind of make friends with the cook, and he just like holds her hostage a little bit because he's like asking her questions. Like, did you have a nice drive up here? Oh, how's it going, type thing? And she's just standing in the doorway and she like can't leave.
Teaching on the periphery, trying to get on with her job.
But yeah,
is he basically a bit of a dick in all her films?
I wonder if they're actually like really good friends.
Yeah, terrible man.
I'd intentionally so in this one. I think he's just trying to kind of grapple with what he believes to be a reality in his world, and reality happens to be the person they've employed to work for them, which is bananas.
But yeah, I think there's a shot in The Souvenir where Julie and Anthony are in Venice and they're going up these stairs, and Julie's in this huge dress shot, and she's like struggling up the stairs. Anthony's just walking about five steps ahead of her, and it's just stuff like that where it's like that tells you so much about their relationship with no words, just from showing you kind of he's not even helping her up the steps. I think there's a lot of that, just kind of placement and showing you without having to tell you. There's a lot of that stuff in there.
She does that quite a lot in Exhibition as well, which is, you know, a film about a sort of artist couple living in this very kind of explicitly arty house, or this apartment. And they're sort of in the process of trying to sell it, but the wife, who's played by Viv Albertine, is much more attached to the house than the husband is. And there are these moments that just seem really out of place and kind of don't initially seem to make much sense, where she's kind of hugging herself round banisters and round, like, kind of, it sounds bizarre, around like hedges in the garden. And it's a bit more sort of abstract, and, you know, but it does convey this, you know, sense of how this is a woman that feels very comfortable in a space that she doesn't necessarily want to let go of, and how she's kind of, she fits in this home, and how she wants to, you know, wants to stay there. So yeah, there's a lot of that kind of body language stuff as well. But I think for me, what I like about Joanna Hogg, and I guess what we've kind of spoken about with some scenes in The Souvenir, is she has known for a very kind of static camera, and just minimal kind of movement, and very relaxed, and just so observational. I think it's like the epitome of observation that she kind of goes for in her films, which is why there's so many different ways that you can interpret what's happening. And you can find things to relate to, you can find things to dislike, people, you can find people insufferable, because you're just watching them do things for a lot of the film. And I think that creates such a big space for your own ideas and your own thoughts.
Absolutely. Because in a way, she's trusting you as the audience to make your own mind up, and she's giving you the opportunity to be creative.
Tied with the fact that she's so self-aware as a director as well. Like I said, like, she knows that her characters are not the nicest of people necessarily, but, you know, people aren't nice. Like, some rich people are awful, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of part of this world that she builds in her stories.
Okay, so we've arrived now at the final chapter of our pod, where we take the bare bones of this woman's legacy and open them into a broader conversation. For this episode, we're looking at women who retell their own stories in film. The Souvenir is a semi-autobiographical film, so lends a lot from Joanna's experiences in her early 20s. Can you think of any female filmmakers who are able to capture moments of their own livelihood or their own experiences in ways that have truly captivated you or kind of strayed from a conventional autobiographical path?
One thing that I really enjoyed recently is I had the great pleasure of working on the film release of Animals, and speaking to writer Emma Jane Unsworth, who was the writer of the novel, and as well got the opportunity to write the script. She basically is talking about the breakup of her and a best girlfriend of hers, platonic relationship, but I think she mines this chapter in her life so beautifully and so poetically in both the book and the film. I just really got a lot from it, both resounding to my own experiences of what it's like to have a girlfriend who you just do everything with, you sleep in the same bed, you wear the same clothes, and then you quite simply grow up and you realize that that's not a sustainable way to become an adult and an individual on your own as a woman. And I just think she nails it, and for her to talk so openly and give us that opportunity to be let into that side of her life was really special, considering this person actually exists as well. And what I also find quite fascinating is that she's still hasn't spoken to that girl, and who knows if she's seen the film. I know.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So
what was it about her retelling of her story that really appealed to you? It was the honesty and the frankness with which she did.
Yeah, it was the honesty and the bravery, I reckon, because a lot of these stories we have that we sometimes think make us sound silly or juvenile, or you know, we're not allowed to have these emotions, but actually to have them written or presented on film or screen or anything, it validates our own experiences and feelings, and it provides solidarity, which is only a good thing to make you realize that you're not the only one going through it, you know. I kind of got the same feeling with Desiree Akhavan's Appropriate Behavior. I think a lot of her own experiences of becoming, coming out to her parents and falling in love for the first time was just so sweet and so raw and funny and enjoyable at the same time. And I love the fact that she gave so much of us. And I think that's a real privilege for us as an audience to have so much of somebody's actual life shown.
I think there's something about showing your own vulnerabilities and showing them the way that you want them to be seen that perhaps allows you to gain some control through doing so. And there must be it's not even catharsis necessarily, but just a way of being able to show people that it's okay to be vulnerable and it's okay to be a woman and be vulnerable in these messy and complex situations that gives you a certain amount of authority.
Yeah, especially if they break away from the normal way that, say, a male director has this idea of what it's like to be a woman, which I'm sure a lot of them do get it right. But, you know, I like to see it from written from a female point of view too.
I mean, they rarely do.
I was being generous. I enjoy women telling women's stories so that I can relate. And I enjoy relating to some of the cinema that I enjoy. I don't have to relate to it all. I don't relate to Star Wars, but. Well, actually, I don't enjoy Star Wars, so that's a bad example. But okay. No, Toy Story. Toy Story's great. I'm not a fork. That plastic fork.
Well, yeah, got me there. Resonated with millions.
How about you, Steph? Could you relay an autobiographical or an interpretation of someone's experiences that's really spoken to you through a female lens?
Yeah, well, I think there's ones that are very, very autobiographical, like Jennifer Fox's The Tale, which was kind of her story of sexual assault when she was very young. And that's almost kind of therapeutic, kind of working through of that. And I think watching something like that was really kind of affecting. And just that's something that's so close to somebody's experience. And it's actually directed by like the person that it's happened to. I don't know like how often that happens and how it's kind of how it can be for that director. So I think something like that was like really special to watch.
I was gonna say, how did you feel actually sitting in that and experiencing it? Did you feel almost like you were intruding in a way?
Yeah, especially because kind of they had to put up disclaimers being like, it's not like a real child, like in the film, like we're using like reenactment and actors and stuff like that, like something that's so, kind of vividly recollected by the filmmaker. That was an intense watch, but I think an important one. But then I think you have things that are less kind of autobiographical and just stories from people who are just from a different culture, a different part of the world, like Haifa al-Mansour, who's like a Saudi Arabian female filmmaker. I think her film Wajda was like the first Saudi Arabian feature film. And she's got a new one coming out. Yeah. She's got a new one coming out. And just, I think, seeing stories from like across the world from a completely different culture from ours is really eye-opening, really interesting. And I just love that, you're getting filmmakers who have just come from this completely different background and are using that background to create new stories that we wouldn't have if all of our directors were British or American white guys or women. So, yeah.
I think you're absolutely right. Those two particular stories help us create empathy, understanding, and it can only make for a better world.
Just makes for richer, one another richer cinema as well.
Absolutely.
Caitlin, how about you? What has kind of spoken to you from an autobiographical standpoint?
Yeah, I think I find it quite interesting when filmmakers maybe don't necessarily use like such explicit examples of trauma that they've experienced or, you know, stories from their own life. Obviously, you know, those stories can be very, very affecting. But I think of a filmmaker like Chantal Ackerman, who in her filmmaking, she was very much concerned with issues of her own identity and sexuality and what it meant to be a woman. And it was sort of fundamentally autobiographical because of her life just being a woman, even if she didn't kind of draw on precise stories or exact stories, everything that she did, that her life as a woman and how she understood her own femininity was just sort of really embedded in her work. And I think there's lots of other female filmmakers that do that, as well as telling the kind of, you know, clearly autobiographical stories. I also think about the film 13, which if I remember correctly, is Nikki Reed's. She didn't direct the film, it's a Catherine Hardwicke film, but Nikki Reed stars in it and I think co-wrote it. And that is based on her own upbringing, as far as I understand.
Yeah, that's such a good example. Yeah, like I've just written about that for somewhere, and it's terrifying that could happen to that kind of age bracket, and the fact that it's kind of rooted in this realism as well is incredible. And how do we feel? So with Joanna Hogg, with this film in particular, she's reluctant to call it autobiographical period. She's very keen to kind of allude to it being semi-autobiographical. I actually had my first question revved up to be, can we talk about the autobiographical references? And then read that she actually hates describing it as that way. Why do you think that is?
I understand that to some extent because, you know, clearly we can understand that this is a semi-autobiographical work because she said that this is based on a real relationship. But when you're working on something that is quite purely an act of memory and an act of kind of rediscovering a past or like reimagining a past, to say that it is autobiographical becomes difficult because there's so many conflicts kind of wrapped up in this idea of, you know, having to remember something, whether you've remembered it accurately, whether you're viewing it from, you know, your own understanding of what happened. And I think that's why, you know, Joanna Hogg says that she needed to kind of create some distance between herself and the story so that she could understand the other sides to it and the other angles. So in a way, it's not just her film. It's not just, you know, her autobiography of, you know, what happened to her. It's trying to come up with a much more rounded view of events that she was involved in, if that makes sense. Like there's something that isn't necessarily autobiographical about that.
Yeah, I think it's a real appreciation to the audience, knowing that the audience will always take whatever it is that is consumed and interpret it in their own sense. So in fact, the more I think about it, the more I totally get it. Like if I tell you what my childhood is and put it on paper, you're going to color it in the way that you color it in with your imagination.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, so, it takes on another life depending on who's absorbing it.
Yeah,
who
exactly.
It resonates with, yeah.
Exactly. Even earlier when that scene was depicted in two different ways by us sitting here, it's all open to interpretation. Yeah. And yes, there is somebody who has been depicted in this film who is not able to clarify certain things. So there's a fairness in that, I guess, and maybe there's a respect.
I think so.
To why she doesn't want to call it purely autobiographical.
And on that note, we'll conclude this episode of Who Is She? A Bechdel Test Fest podcast. Karina, can you tell people where they can find out more about the Bechdel Test Fest's events and upcoming news and updates?
Yes, you can. On all the usual social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, we've got it all. We've also got a blog. We've also got a website. Yep, so BechdelTestFest.com, and that's your best spot for everything Bechdel Test Fest.
Please do keep your eyes peeled on our social media channels where we'll be posting updates of our next podcast episode, which will be something a little bit different, a little bit exciting. We'll tell you more another time. Steph, you've got an exciting announcement for us for an upcoming screening, if you'd like to tell everyone.
Yeah, we've got a special 10th anniversary screening of Whip It, Drew Barrymore's directorial debut. It's got a huge cast. It's got Ellen Page. It's got Alia Shawkat. It's got Eve, which I know you're very excited about.
I'm so excited. Eve, who now lives in London, who's married a millionaire.
We've got to track her down.
Who knew?
She needs to come.
She must come to the screening. Eve, if you're
listening.
Eve, if you're listening. Yeah. It's on the 4th of November at the Prince Charles Cinema, and you can find tickets on their website or through our socials as well.
I think if we get Eve, we should rename the podcast Who's That Girl instead of Who Is
She? That would be amazing.
Mic drop.
I mean, I went, this equipment was expensive. So on that note, I will bid farewell to my wonderful Bechdel Test Fest partners in crime. Ladies, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is She? A Bechdel Test Fest podcast is a Bechdel Test Fest production. It was written and hosted by Beth Webb and produced by Stephanie Watts, with additional support from Karina Antrobus and Caitlin Quinlan. Our music was written and produced by Zoe Mead. Check out her band Wildest on all major streaming platforms.